But today I'll start English, not like last week. As you remember, last week we talked about writing papers. I hope the few pieces of advice that I gave you were useful. As I said in the beginning, if you learn one or two tricks during each of the meetings and keep using them for the rest of your career, you've spent well the 2 hours of our meetings. Today, I'm going to present you a few tricks about presentations. So, presentation is another way of selling your results. It's a very inexpensive way because it's so easy to prepare a presentation, just a few hours, prepare a few slides, and then go and present. By the way, there's going to be a conference in Białystok right here for doctoral students. I assume most of you have already submitted your papers to that conference. It's an opportunity to talk, to present. So this is what we are going to talk about. And here is where we are. I updated the list. The red is today. Dark, kind of medium blue is what we have covered. Light blue, gray are things that we are not going to talk about. And things in dark blue are still going to be covered. We lost a class last week. I decided that scientific creativity would be a good class to lose. If you want, we can meet one extra time in May if you want to, or whoever wants, we can do that. I can also make it available to you, a recording from one of the last few years, in case you are interested in that. It's actually quite interesting stuff also. But today, presentations in front of an audience. Here's the brief outline. As always, a little bit of motivation. Then materials, skills, that's it. And then a concept of elevator pitch. You will find it very useful in scientific meetings whenever you meet somebody, another scientist, so it's a good idea to actually be prepared for it. Being in the audience is another thing, and then a few concluding remarks. Why presentations why are they important? It's one of the easiest way of advertising your work. You just go somewhere and present. You should do it whenever you can. I mentioned to you in the context of networking that if you go to Kraków next week or next month, you write your colleague, I'm going to visit Kraków. What does the colleague answer? Wonderful. It will be nice to see you. Would you like to come and give a presentation in our research group? What is your answer? I'll be delighted to. Yes? So every time there's an opportunity, use it. And scientific meetings, workshops, symposia, conferences, definitely good way of practicing your skills, of selling your work. The best teacher is practice. Of course, the first time you present, it will take you hours to prepare, to practice. You will be a little bit shy. Things will not go exactly as you wish, as you want it. But the next time is going to be a little bit better. And after 20, 30 times, you are going to prepare presentations within just a few hours, just putting some existing slides together, a good story, and it's going to be easy. Use every opportunity, as I said, whenever visiting somebody, definitely arrange to speak. If somebody is visiting you, ask them to speak. It's very efficient. Just an hour of talk, you will learn useful stuff. If you learn just a few things, it's well spent time. This is an important slide, believe it or not. It's obvious, but it's very important. You present to be understood. Why did I put that slide? Because I notice sometimes people try to sound very, very wise. It's almost like you see sometimes an interview with somebody who is, I don't know, a policeman or some local government official or some worker, and they try to use very, very wise language to the point of, really, you don't know what's going on. What do they want? We used to have a secretary here in the department. She would sometimes send a message to the mailing list, and frankly, I didn't know what she wanted. You know, I read the whole message. I still didn't know what she wanted. She wanted to sound very wise, very indirect. Maybe she was using passive voice, whatever. I couldn't understand what she wanted. So the ground rule, whenever you present to be understood. Why do you want people to understand you? Very important idea. If they understand you, they will be able to ask questions, because if they don't understand it, they will not even know what to talk about, what to ask. So you really want them to follow you to understand, to give you feedback, which is very, very important. Also, when they understand, they feel better. They feel, wow, that was nice, I understand it. They will also like you more. They will like your work. It's understood, it's good, well-motivated, etc. So, one of the most important slides today. You want to be understood. Sometimes I've seen presentations where scientists try to be very, very wise, put a lot of formulas, almost like on purpose, they want to be not understood. Then they go in the presentation, the time ends, and then they grab the rest of the slides and say, well, sorry, I have no time to present the rest. I'm a very intelligent, great person, I have a lot of things to show, but unfortunately the time is repressive, I cannot show it to you. This kind of attitude is absolutely a no-no. Don't ever do that. You really want to be understood. It's a very important slide. Before you prepare your talk, before you go anywhere, you need to know the audience. You need to know what they already know, what they want to hear. And during the presentation, you want to keep contact with the audience. Whenever I am to present something, I mean, outside of professional meetings, if it's a conference, you can make certain assumptions about people knowing things, because it's a specialized conference. But if I go to visit, let's say, a department, computer science department in another university, I usually ask the person who invited me, who is arranging it, will the people there know Bayesian networks? Yes. Do they know a little bit of statistics? I usually probe, I ask what they know, because that helps me to present the introductory slides, to frame my presentation. So it's always a good idea to know who the audience are, if they will understand you. And if you don't know, just ask. And it's so easy to ask, they will answer you. They will give you an idea. We start with the structure of the talk. Similarly to a paper, we talked about papers last week, talks also have to have a clear structure and a logical flow. You should introduce, motivate the problem, and things that you are going to talk about. People need to feel the importance of what you are talking about. If it's not important, why would they listen to? By the way, I heard an interesting joke about, scientific joke. A young man comes to Plato and says, I have news for you, I want to tell you something. Plato, in a philosophical stand, says, wonderful, but let me subject your news to three questions. The first thing is, are you sure about what you are going to tell me about? The guy says, no, now that you ask, I don't know for sure. The second question is the news good or bad? The guy says, well, it's not very good. And the last test is, will I be better off by knowing it or not? And the guy says, well, now that you ask, I don't think you will be better off. So Plato says, why do I want to hear it? I don't want to even hear it, what you came with. And this is how Plato missed the information that I forgot who it was. Pythagoras was having an affair with his wife. So, you know, I thought about this joke because of that motivation. You know, why would people want to hear something? Why would they want to know? So, present the problem, the importance of it. Why is it of essence? Why people should know it? Why should they should hear it? Then show a way of addressing the problem. You see that similar something similar in the in papers. And then during the talk, you should think ahead before the presentation about so-called take-home message. What is a take-home message? When I exit the audience, you know, I thank the speaker. On the way home, in the doorway, there is some sentence, some message that I want to take with me from the talk. There's usually not too many things that you will remember from a talk, but there is something that you want to take with you, and the speaker should prepare the presentation in such a way that take-home message is clear and, of course, in a subtle way, and they take it out with them. The slides. Not too much text, definitely. The mistake that many people do is putting long sentences, you know, a whole paragraph. It's okay sometimes, of course, if you want to have a quote of somebody, some longer thing, but generally it's not a good idea. It's better to just put a few words and then talk around them. Sufficiently large font. To give you an idea, some of you are in the back. I have increasingly a problem with that because my eyes are getting worse. And the title is 24. And this is, I think, 20. I rarely go below 18. This is smaller. You may not be able to read it from the very, very back. But these are things that you saw in the very beginning. It's just an idea. And, well, I could probably even read it from the back myself. But this is a very small font. I forgot what it is. 12 maybe or so. Just the outline of the presentation. So not too small font, because if it's too small, people will not be able to read it. And keep in mind that not everybody is as young as you are. When people get older, they have difficulties with reading small font. So this 20 is okay, really. I think you can probably read it easily from the back. I try not to go much below that. Guidance to the audience, how far you are in the presentation. And there are many ways of doing this. This is an advice I got when I was finishing my doctoral studies. I gave a presentation, and one of the people in the audience, a psychologist, said, you know, I've seen somebody present, and they had some kind of guidance. They had a list, or they had a bar that showed how far they are, a bar with a few keywords, and then the bar got darker as they went to, so the audience knew where you are. From that point on, I started doing this, and I have it on all my presentations when I teach, when I present. I usually have an outline and showing where I am. Why is it important? Well, you know, people look outside of the window, they get a message, some are tempted even to look at their Facebook page, and they get distracted, and then they lose the thread. So this helps them to see where you are going. Pictures and graphs, whenever you can, whenever it's appropriate, of course. There's a saying in English, a picture is worth more than 1,000 words. That's usually true, not always, but usually it's true. Pictures are usually showing the ideas more clearly. Less is often more. So less information on the slides is usually, and less presenting less is usually better, because you don't overload your audience with too much information. So these are some general advice that I heard over time, and I do think they are good advices. Audio, video, and demos. Of course, these days you can do it. My computer is connected to the screen, also to speakers. I could play things, I could make noises, etc. First, audio elements. Try not to use them at all unless you have a piece of a movie or recording or something. But generally, don't use useless beautifiers. I remember once I was in a talk. It was at Carnegie Mellon. There was a distinguished professor visiting from another university, and she was probably quite. She loved the, you know, the animation and sounds. She would the points would come in from left to right, and they were making noise like zzz, and next point zzz, and every time there was a zzz, the audience was laughing. That's the way that scientists usually receive useless sounds and animation. Just don't do that. When I was first learning to present, that was early 80s, I think. That was in the Netherlands. There was a teacher who was... we used to have overhead slide projectors. I don't know if you know what they are. They were like small things with a lamp. You put clear... a sheet of plastic on it, and the lamp was projecting, shining through. There was like a mirror with on the top that was presenting it on the wall. And he was advising to put a piece of paper on it and then present points one by one so that people don't read ahead. I used to do it in PowerPoint later, having gotten this advice, and I would, you know, click, 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 the new points would show. I stopped doing this. I noticed that it's actually not that great of an idea. I don't know if you've ever do that. So I just show everything and then talk on. So I used to do it one by one and hide, but I don't do that anymore. I'm not feeling strongly about this, but I feel it works better for me. Movie clips are a good idea if you have something to show. If we have some time, I'll play you some interesting presentations that you may find useful to see. They are nice. They provide a nice diversification if, of course, they play an important role in your presentation. Software demos are great, but just keep in mind that software usually breaks, crashes during presentations. So make sure that the software is reliable, that you can reliably demonstrate it. Jokes are fine, but they are risky, of course. If you are not humorous by nature, don't do that, because I usually like telling jokes when I'm in a company. So, as you notice, I do tell sometimes jokes in my classes, and I hope they are reasonably funny. I usually tell jokes when they are illustrating a point, so not just a joke to make to make people laugh, but sometimes the conversation or the situation. I recall a joke that that is suitable for that. So jokes are fine, but they're risky. They're risky because if you are not naturally good at telling jokes, it's not going to be too funny. Another risky thing is that often jokes are laughing at some type of people, whatever. And if you find such people in the audience, then they may feel a little bit hurt. I'm not advocating political correctness, which I find despicable. I'm trying to be as incorrect as I can, although I don't like insulting people without any reason. But I just mean you don't want to lose anybody. If you insult somebody in the audience, or if you insult a student when you are teaching, that's really bad, because you are losing that person. That person is not going to be listening as attentively as he or she should. So it's usually not a good idea. You tell a joke about bald people and you see a bald person in the audience who may be very sensitive, and this kind of thing. So it's a little bit risky. So avoid also risky jokes and risky statements. Try not to, because you may lose somebody. The font is too small, so I should read. Harry discovers that there is more to effective presentations than meets the eye. he's giving a presentation to a blind person, and of course that's a very bad preparation. He doesn't know his audience. I said that graphs are usually, pictures are usually worth 1,000 words, but they cannot be too complicated, of course. And whenever you show a picture, you should guide the people in understanding the picture, what it shows. And this is, of course, a joke. The guy says, I'll pause for a moment so that you can let this information sink in. Of course, that's a useless, useless picture. Beautifiers, I told you about the sounds, the animation. I would say don't use sounds at all. Animation, use it only whenever it serves a purpose. And not too many colors. Psychologists have found that 5 ± 2 colors are sufficient. So not too many colors. A few is fine because they stress things, but not too many. Here is a picture from an excellent book by Edward Tufte on presenting quantitative information. It's a collection of 3 books. I have them somewhere on my shelf if you are interested. Well, not this semester because I'm packed in boxes this semester, but next year I can show it to you. So this is actually an animation that you should see. You see the sound, the animation, which was completely useless. And also this chart is very bad chart. It's an example of bad charts. The chart is showing where designers are rock stars, relative salaries equalized via the PPD, I think it's purchasing power, Big Mac index, whatever that is. In any case, the bad thing about it is that they show the map of the country, the color of the map of the country. So this is England, this is India, isn't it? No, this is India, I think. I don't even know what this is. That's a problem. I don't know what it is. Maybe there's this...
Hong Kong,
it's written here. But the bad thing about this graph is that we don't know if it's area or height of the person, for example. Yes? It may be misleading. And of course, I introduced the animation and sound just to make things even worse. So don't do things like that. And when you show graphs, show them in a way that is they are understood. Very often I get the question, obvious question, how much time should you prepare for? Whenever you go and you're going to give a talk, you should absolutely know how long you can talk. In conferences, it's usually very clear. There's a session, there's a plan of the session, and typically your presentation is 15, 20 minutes, sometimes 25, but usually not longer, a conference presentation. It's typically 20. Whenever you are visiting a research group in another city, another university, ask them, how long should I talk? They can tell you, well, our seminars are usually an hour. Well, then you know that you should leave at least 15 minutes for questions. So, you know, you should talk for 40, 45 minutes. In any case, don't even start without knowing how long you should talk. And you should never exceed the allocated time. Never. So the situation when you are kind of grabbing the rest of the slides and leaving, that's a no-no. You shouldn't do that. You should talk the allotted time. In a conference... You have to stop, really, because there are other people who are going to talk after you. And what happens is, when you talk in a conference, usually the chair of the session will show you, typically on a piece of paper, 5 minutes left or 1 minute left. Or when you exceed the time, they will get up, which is a sign for you to wrap up, to get to the last slide. If you don't do that, they will start walking towards you. They may actually say, well, I'm sorry, but you have exceeded your time. So that's a very bad situation. So never more. You should really keep the time. How many slides should you have? There is a heuristic that I heard years ago, around 1 slide per minute of your presentation. That's just a heuristic that can be definitely violated. I've seen definitely counterexamples of that. Some people have much fewer, some people have many more. I remember I was once participating in a PhD defense of a doctoral student, and I was one of the members of the committee, which is comparable to a reviewer of the dissertation. And she sent me the slides before the defense, a day before the defense. And typically defenses consist of a presentation of 30, 40 minutes by the person defending. And she sent me 130-something slides. So I kind of gently asked her by email, do you think it's not too many slides? And she said, no, no, it's not too many. The last 15 are backup slides, and I have practiced. I thought, well, she should know. And you know what? She really finished on time, which was very nice. So this was definitely an example of a violation of that rule. That rule can be easily violated. But if you don't know in the beginning how many, it's a good heuristic. Then practice and see with the time, with the stopwatch, see how long it takes. But 1 minute per slide is a good heuristic. Here is an interesting thing that happened to me when I was preparing, I think maybe it was my job talk. There was an opening, I was invited as one of the candidates to come to give a talk, and I was giving so-called dry run, which is a practice talk with some people in the department, some friends, a few professors who wanted to help. And one of the professors, the same who mentioned the outline, he said, I noticed that in the beginning you were hesitating. You started with your title talk and you didn't know how to start. So it took a few seconds before you started talking. So he told me you should prepare an opening thing. An opening thing can be anything, like today, good morning, today I'm going to talk about this and that. Or when they introduce you, you say something, thank you, it's so nice to be back after 20 years at this university. Or thank you for this introduction. Say something, but prepare it, be ready. This lady, it is an anecdote I encountered. I was still a student, doctoral student at Carnegie Mellon. And this lady was visiting. She was visiting many places, many universities. You probably don't know who she is. Her name is Ruth Westheimer. She was an Israeli psychologist, maybe living in the U.S., I don't know. I don't know if she's still alive or not. I haven't checked recently. And she was teaching Americans how to have sex, essentially. That's kind of, blunt statement, in one sentence what she was doing. So she would. She had also columns in different magazines, explaining all the technicalities and a very prudish society, so, that was kind of a sensation. So she would visit different universities, and she visited Carnegie Mellon, and I wasn't there. I guess I didn't feel the need to learn anything from her. But then I read a funny article in the university newspaper. The article went as follows. After her short presentation, there was a question and answer session, and people were asking questions, and she would answer. Again, the technicalities of the main topic. And then the journalist wrote, there was this young man, a student probably, towards the back of the audience, who raised his hand. She said, yes. He got up, and then his face turned red, and then blue, and then green, and then yellow, and, and it lasted a few seconds. It looks like he didn't... He couldn't say anything. So the journalist wrote that Dr. Ruth Westheimer said to him, start in the following way. My friend has the following problem. It was just funny. It wasn't funny. Nothing. He was clearly shy of to ask a question that bothered him, so she advised to describe it as his friend's problem. Sometimes I see in discussions in Polish nie dla siebie, dla kolegi pytam, prawda? The same thing, yes. So this young man was asking. So anyway, the opening. It's a typical novice mistake. So be prepared. Have a sentence that you want to say. If everything else fails, you kind of blank, just say that sentence. So good to have the opening. Something easy, something nice. Your speech. No stop words like actually. Some people repeat the same thing many, many times during the presentation. So some people say pravda 57 times in half an hour. Or movements are later in the speech. So, of course, everybody does this. I do that too. But I had an interesting adventure that made me aware of that in my own speech. I was a member of an organization called Toastmasters International. I'll tell more about this later. Because I'm very curious always. So I was alone in the US at IBM, my first months in US. I was doing all kinds of crazy things. I went to a shooting club because somebody said, okay, we are going to have a meeting of the shooting club. And I thought, well, shooting is what Marek's like most. So I want to go. But the guy asked me, fine, come, 5 o'clock Saturday. What kind of guns do you have? I have no guns. So he said, well, don't worry, we have guns. Well, they had guns, I was shooting. In any case, there was another announcement from Toastmasters International. I didn't know them, but I joined them because I read about them, that they help you to practice your presentation skills. So every week that we were meeting, just one meeting a week, whatever, Friday lunchtime, there was somebody giving a presentation, and there was also there was always somebody designated to criticize the presentation. There was somebody who was supposed to count the etc. So I prepared my presentation. It took me hours to prepare. I had my slides, and it was funny, and this and that. I gave the presentation. Of course, I got some useful feedback about my skills. But then the person who was supposed to count the got up and said 37. And I thought, boy, in 10-minute presentation, I said 37 times That was really bad. So from that point on, I started to really pay attention to what I'm saying. And all kinds of stop words. If you record yourself, that's a very similar experience. You'll see that you are saying those things, then you'll stop doing this. Don't read your text. Some people have slides and they read their text either standing in front of their laptops like this. They do not read your text. Say things in your own words. Explain as if you were explaining to your colleague. That's usually very, very boring when the audience sees you read the text. So never do that. Put just a few words, and once in a while you can glance at the slides to remind you what you should talk about, but practice and know what you are going to talk about. In the practice talk that you do at home, yourself, or with other people, you learn essentially what you want to say. Don't read. Two reasons, of course. You don't have contact with the audience when you read, and it is also very boring. Also, use very informal language. Those of you who have seen me in presentations, in seminars, I often ask a very malicious question. So when I hear somebody in the presentation say things in passive voice, in Polish it's so funny, they say, przeprowadzono eksperyment, zmierzono, dokonano, zaimplementowano, etc. Apparently, this is the old way of presenting that is still taught to people. Don't ever do that. When you present, just use very informal language. I implemented the program, I conducted the experiments, here's what I noticed. First person, active voice. Whenever I hear the passive voice, I usually raise my hand during this question session and say, I'm sorry, I always ask this question, I know it's a very malicious question, złośliwe, but let me ask you. You said przeprowadzono, zrobiono, all the things. Who did that? Your wife, your girlfriend, who did that? Of course, they say, no, I did it. Why are you using that very impersonal things? If I ask my wife to write a paper for me, prepare a presentation, do the experiments, then I would come, present, and say it was implemented, it was done, etc. I wouldn't even be lying, right? Somebody did it, my wife did it. So you see how unclear it is. You just use very simple language. The best presentations are people who are using very simple language. Very, very simple language. Understandable, understood language. Physical behavior is another thing that is very important in presentations. Definitely, during the presentation, keep contact with the audience. So look at them. Look at different people, and especially people who you see that are following, that are interested in your talk. So keep the contact. When you keep contact with the audience, that also makes the audience feel better. You know, you don't stand like this and present, showing not the best part of yourself to the audience. Just be in front, relaxed, and talk to the audience. Be natural, because if you are not natural, you look funny. That's a general rule. If you do something not natural to yourself, you usually look funny. You must have noticed that in just social interactions. People who are doing something that really is not in their nature, it looks so surprising, so funny. So just be natural, the way you are. If you are by nature sad, well, just be sad, although smiling is a good idea, I think. If you feel nervous, sometimes, especially in the beginning, the first few presentations, there is a trick that I learned, that I heard, and I think it's a good trick. Look at the audience, find the people who are listening to you. When you have identified them, just look at them and keep contact with them. Don't bother about the people who are, you know, checking their Facebook pages or whatever. There are people like this too. Look at the people who are listening to you. That will also give you, unconsciously, it will make you more confident. You are talking to somebody who is listening, and it makes you feel better. So look at the people who are listening to you. There are many, many nervous behaviors that people do, you know, like do this, they do that. We used to have a professor when I was studying at Warsaw University of Technology in 1970s. There was a professor, actually Dr. Klukowski. He had a weekly column in the local newspaper, Życie Warszawy, Zapytajmy Arcymistrza, ask the Archmaster. He was a master in bridge, card game, bridge game. When he was giving lectures, it was so funny. He had those nervous things, like he did that often, doing this when he was talking. Another thing he did was all kinds of, you know, clearing his throat. We were joking among the students, not in the lecture, but outside of the lecture, that he was explaining, showing us his cards, you know, all kinds of different movements. It was just funny. I hope he's still alive, because that was many, many years ago. He was already in his probably 50s at that time. So, but many people do nervous things. Everybody does it. The best thing to do is to record yourself. When you record yourself, you will see all kinds of funny things that you're doing. When I say the different movements, I don't mean that you should stand like this. Moving is fine. Moving, you notice me moving, showing, that makes the presentation more lively. It's not like, you know, stand like this and barely move your lips. No, do something, but don't do those nervous things that don't have any function, that look funny. Just avoid that. The best way is to look at yourself. So look at the recording of yourself. No nervous movements. This is a good joke. I'm going to wait until the end if we have time left, because I don't want to hurry it. But it's a good Jewish joke. Jewish humor is very. I like it a lot. I think it resembles Polish humor, and maybe because many Jewish people come from this region, so it's a good joke. I'll tell you that later. It has to do with presentations. I mentioned it already a couple of times. It's a good exercise because it's really a torture when you watch yourself. It's really a very masochistic experience. When I hear my voice recorded, I'm recording myself for you, but I hate listening to it. When I listen to my own voice, I think, well, I would never even get to like that person with such an unpleasant voice. When I watch myself recorded, I also dislike myself too. I'm noticing all kinds of errors that I make in my presentations. So it's not a very nice experience. Therefore, do it yourself. Take a smartphone. They can so easily record things now. Record your presentation at home and watch it yourself without any people around you. You will notice a lot of things that you are doing not completely right, and it will help you a lot, really. Handling questions, and that has to do with both presentations and teaching. And many of you will be teaching, maybe you are already teaching. Handling questions is really a killer, killer in terms of a good teacher or good presenter who is disliked or the presentation is killed by not a good way of handling questions. You can say, for example, somebody asks you a question, you can, of course, say something like, that's a stupid question. If I say that, suppose you there ask me a question, I said, that's a stupid question. What happens then? In your mind, I will never again ask a question to that guy. And what is in your mind? I'm not going to ask questions either. Because he is going to treat me the way he treated her. Yes?
And maybe that you don't know the answer to that question.
That's another possibility, of course, yes. In any case, don't ever think of handling questions this way, both as a presenter or as a teacher. If a student asks you a question, and you say something like, well, I talked for half an hour about it last week, that's another thing that will kill the interaction. Every question that a student asks, well, you know, sometimes they may be naive questions, sometimes they may be not very well thought through, but they are valuable. They keep contact between you and the audience. The same with the audience. So every time somebody asks a question, handle it very nicely. Even if you think it's a stupid question, handle it nicely. I remember when I was in one of my first courses as a doctoral student, it was a course by Herb Simon, many people in the audience, not only people registered for the course, but also people who just wanted to hear him. I remember somebody asked really a stupid question. He asked a question that he was really talking the whole previous meeting about. The way he handled it is the following. He kind of attentively listened to the question and said, oh, I see. And then he answered that question. Most of the audience thought, well, that was a stupid question. That guy clearly wasn't there. That's why he asked the question, but he still just answered it. So do this it's a good metaphor maybe. Do that Christian behavior of turning your other cheek. You know, even if they ask you really stupid questions, be very benevolent, like be a good teacher in presentations and and conferences and in teaching. What can you say? Instead of this is a stupid question, you can say, well, that is an interesting question. I have never thought about it this way. Yes? And very often you'll be amazed, but these kind of naive, you could say silly or stupid questions are very, very valuable because they tell you that you should explain it in another way. You didn't understand it the way you explained it, so maybe there is another way of explaining it. Those naive questions very often will help you as a researcher in thinking about the topic in another way. If you haven't read the collection of books by Richard Feynman, there's a book, Surely You Are Joking, Mr. Feynman, and the second book is What Do You Care What Other People Think? Two thin paperbacks, they are translated into Polish, both of them. I definitely recommend anybody who wants to become a scientist, because here is a great scientist, Nobel Prize winner, who writes about his life and his career and interesting things. And there is a chapter in that book, I forgot the title. Maybe the title is The Distinguished Professor. In fact, I have an important piece of the chapter on my webpage. Let me show you. It's a really very nice thing. He describes, he says, I could never live without teaching. That's big, we don't want. Okay, so I hope there is internet here. Yeah, there is internet. Let me see, do I have that quote here? No, I don't. Oh, that's terrible. Then I have it in Pittsburgh, probably. Give me a moment. Where is it? I think it's here. I just put it, that whole section of that chapter. Is it loading or not? Not yet. Okay, here it is. So here's from the book. I'm not going to read it, of course, it's a very short piece, but what I wanted to say about this, summarize it, is that Feynman gives two reasons why he would never want to live without teaching in that chapter. The first reason is that as a researcher, he has periods when he is flying, he has many ideas, he's very productive, publishing papers. He feels very good about his research program. And then there are longer periods, he writes, where he has no ideas, no inspiration, and teaching helps him to feel useful at that time. So that's the first reason why he likes teaching. The second reason is that he keeps in touch, he keeps contact with people, with other people, with ideas. Sometimes he writes those silly, naive questions, bring ideas to his mind. Now that's why he likes being around young people and teaching. He gives example of people who are isolated from other people, and they were not very productive. He gives example of people, I think, in the Princeton Institute of Advanced Studies, I think. They were isolated because of secrecy. They produced nothing. So the important thing, the interaction and questions and answers. So there are many ways of doing this. Sometimes you can overdo it, of course. A colleague here in the department told me that he was once at a conference where there was somebody presenting, I think it was an American researcher. Every time somebody asked a question, he said, that's a good question. That's a good question. That's a good question. Sounded very artificial, of course. Don't do that. But there are many ways of saying something nice about a question. Even looking, with your look, you can express gratitude in the way you answer that question. Just respectfully, treat it seriously. If you don't understand the question, try to clarify it first. In any case, make people feel welcome. There's another thing that is happening here also. in research environments, I have mentioned that already before, one of the driving forces of scientists is vanity. Vanity, próżność. What do I mean by that? Well, you know, we scientists think that we are smarter than others. We are smart, and we want to show off by being smart. When we present something, we want people to look like that and then clap like this, you know, wow, this is great work. When we ask questions, being in the audience, we want others to think, wow, that's a great question. He got precisely to the point of that presentation. So you should, in order not to lose anybody, especially in important situations like your job talk, when you are going to be accepted or not in that department, they can offer you a job or not, and many people will be voting, you need to give them what they want. So never put them down. It's safer to say that's a good question. This question gets to the center of this idea. I'm sorry for not having said that myself. Yes, or I have already thought about this. It's definitely a critical issue here. Yes, so make them feel good also. There's a song by Bua Tokujawa. I don't know if this is the generation that knows who is Bua Tokujawa. Some people know, some. There's a song, Prayer of François Villon, where he sings, give everybody what he wants. Give a coward a horse so that he can escape. Give a rich man more money. And give give somebody who desires power, give him power also, yes? Do that a little bit too. It's a safe thing to do. There's another anecdote that I remember. In my department, where I got my PhD from, there was a guy, a very bright fellow also, very smart researcher, who stayed at the department in the department because he didn't get a job yet. He was trying to get a job, a faculty position. He was invited a few times every year. There was a faculty search, they invited him for a job talk, but he never got the job. So it lasted for a couple of years. And the department chair, actually through his channels, through the network, remember the importance of the network, he actually called them and said, well, you know, tell me why you didn't accept him. You know, just honest opinion, why he didn't get the job, what was wrong with him, etc. And he learned that it was the way he handled questions. So when he handled the questions, I guess he wasn't very welcoming. He was maybe not rude, but not very friendly. And that was also telling the people that he may not be a good teacher, because a teacher has to have a good way of handling questions. A good teacher keeps contact with the students, with the audience. So it's really very important. And you want people to ask questions. Why would you want to discourage them from asking questions? Here is a collection of different pieces that I would advise you to watch just for inspiration. I collected them over years. Here is Professor Łukasz Turski. I believe he died just recently. I heard it this year or last year. I was driving somewhere in Białystok, and I listened to first radio program, and there was an interview with him. And I loved the way he talked about science. He used such a simple language that anybody could understand, and he was a bright physicist, very, you know, good professor. I just love the way he talked about science. And here is a link to a recording. Just, you know, listen to it for an inspiration. You'll see that you love it. After that, when I got to work, I sent him an email. I found him. I sent him an email saying, I just listened to the interview and I loved it. And I will take the liberty to show it to my students, which is what I'm doing. He he liked it a lot. He responded. It was very nice of him. But anyway, good example of using very simple language. That's what I liked about him. Here is another interview with Wiesław Binienda. He's a professor in Ohio State, I think, if I'm not mistaken. He became known in Poland because after the 2010 crash of the presidential airplane, he studied, he did the thing that he did best in his research. He studied the collision of the airplane with the birch that was on the way. According to the report of Anodina, the Mack report, the plane hit the birch tree, lost part of the wing, and that caused it further the catastrophe. He had done it many times on different materials, so he knew how to do it. He built a model and has shown that even with a very wide margin, with assuming that the tree was much stronger than it really was, that the airplane was weaker than it really was, every simulation he ran, the tree was cut like like grass with a lawnmower. So he became known with that, and there were many, many people who were, very much against that. As one of the politicians, I forgot her name, said, "Prawda została ustalona, żadne fakty jej nie zmienią." The truth has been decided; no facts will change it. Of course, as scientists, you understand the irony of that statement. In any case, he was in 2011 invited to the Polish TV, and the interviewer was one of those quite repulsive characters, I have to say. And you will see that in that interview, that she's quite repulsive. She's trying to get him to lose his thread, to lose his nerves. He keeps addressing him, "Panie doktorze, panie doktorze, skocz po kawę," this kind of talking. But he is very, very, he is very good. I really liked that interview. I watched it accidentally because I don't have a TV, but we were, I think, at my parents-in-law. I watched that piece or maybe later. Watch that piece, you'll see how well he handles that that aggressive and not very competent journalist. It's really very good inspiration. So, whether you, it's hard to say you disagree with him without actually being very well versed in mechanics. I heard him, I investigated his reputation. He's a very good researcher. His reputation in terms of publications, grants, etc., nothing wrong with him. So definitely he should be treated seriously. But anyway, that interview is really very, very good example, inspiring example. Two examples in English. There is, I don't know if you know Jordan Peterson. Who knows him? Single people. If you don't know him, watch this interview here. It's an interview on British Channel 4, BBC, an interview with Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson became famous because when they wanted to mandate by law the use of the new pronouns, instead of, he, she, they wanted to use mandate. So compulsory law that says you have to use them or them, whatever, the new things. He said, "No, I'm not going to do that." There was even a congressional hearing in Canada of him. So this journalist in BBC invited him for a half an hour interview, trying to essentially show how stupid, how fascist, how bad he is. And he is very, very smart. He's excellent. Watch that interview, see how well he handles the questions from her, and actually how well he shows her that she is unprepared for that presentation. That's another thing of, sorry for Polish here, but these are Polish things, how to answer questions from aggressive and not completely competent journalists. There's another guy, if we have time, which we may not have, we can actually play a piece. Here's a piece where he is attacked at one of the meetings. That's another guy that I definitely recommend. Very sharp guy. Very sharp. I would think, I don't know, I'm not an expert, but his IQ is probably 150 or better. He speaks fast, he thinks fast, he is very to the point with the responses. Ben Shapiro, Orthodox Jew, you can see a yarmulke here, conservative, and also deals with that craze that was happening in the US until recently, you know, the woke, the gender ideology, etc. And at his talks, of course, they try to cancel him, to get him out. The same with Peterson. He gets questions, and look at the way he handles them. It's just amazingly good and to the point. So you have to be prepared sometimes when you talk to media, especially. All of these examples are with media. So not other scientists, but media. Earlier or later, you will be approached by the media, and you have to be prepared. Simple language, to the point, and also be prepared that if your findings are controversial, not very likely in technical sciences, but it may happen, like in case of Binienda, you have to be prepared for that also. Good inspiration. If you like these talks, you can find many recordings with them on YouTube. The same, of course, with Tursky and Binienda. I'm sure there will be many more. Toastmasters International. I mentioned to you my adventure with Toastmasters. I went to those meetings for a year, and then I left IBM, and I didn't have time to go to those meetings. But it's an international organization. There's a Polish branch also. Here is Warsaw. I think Białystok branch has just a Facebook page. But they are active. I just checked today. They have meetings regularly. There's an event in May also. If you think you can improve your presentation skills, definitely advise to visit, to take part in the meetings. Very nice organization. Toastmasters, because masters of toast. You raise at the table and say, I'm toasting to all those who are at the sea, Toastmasters. But not only toast, but also generally public speaking. The next thing, we are approaching the end already, is the concept of elevator speech. It comes from venture capital, from startup world, venture capitalists. The idea is that they don't have the time to talk to you for too long. They want you to tell what you are doing, why you need the money for, what do you need the money for, why they should invest in you. They don't have the time. So they want you to present something very, very briefly, to the point, and that's it. Maybe this is the only opportunity you will get to present with them. Elevator pitch, it's because you can talk for as long as it takes to go by elevator from the zero to the fifth floor. That's it. Then you are exiting, or they are exiting. That's it. So very, very short speech. And you can find audiences for this kind of presentations in many places, queuing up for coffee during a break in a conference. You stand next to a person. What do you do? What should you do? You should smile, look at them, and say, hi, I'm Marek. Where are you from? I'm from Krakow, yes, from Jagiellonian University. What are you doing? In terms of research, of course. And then that's the opportunity for that person, yes? That person will say 1-2 minutes what she is doing. Of course, she should ask me, what are you doing? And that's my opportunity then. If she doesn't ask, well, lost opportunity, yes? But so people will ask you that question. You should be prepared always for that. 30 seconds, not more. Just very brief. If you sense interest, then you say more, if you get questions from them. But if there is no interest, they are not asking any more questions, stop talking. Some people once you ask them, they keep talking and talking and talking, and you look at the watch, you look at the coffee. Coffee is getting cold, and they keep talking. Never do that. Don't be boring. Being boring is worse than what? I don't know. Be prepared. Once I was visiting a colleague in National University of Singapore, and she had a lab of, I don't know, maybe 10 people. All of them were Chinese, I think. Almost all of them, or all of them were Chinese, from China and from Singapore. As you know, Singapore is 70% of the people are Chinese in Singapore. In any case, they have the reputation of being a little shy, and of course, they were struggling also with English. And we went to the lab with her and sat at the table, and she said, "Oh, maybe you can say tell our guests what you are doing." And each of them was giving the elevator speech, and it was funny because when they were speaking, they often looked up in the ceiling as if they memorized that. It looked really funny and very boring, actually. So don't do that. You should have a very relaxed 30-second answer to what you are doing. It should be very natural, very relaxed. If they ask you questions, of course, you can talk much longer. You've worked long enough on your problems that you can talk much longer about your work. It's important in networking, learning what happens in your field, what people are doing. When you go to conferences, the most important things are really meetings with other people, the networking. So these are the things that are more important than your presentation, than attending, asking questions. It's nice to present, a good opportunity to advertise your work, but this is more valuable, it's more lasting. So it's an overview of an idea for a product, service, or project, in your case, a scientific problem. I already explained that it's used in the entrepreneurship world. Venture capitalists want to hear it. These are actually pieces from Wikipedia which you can read. And many people use that, scientists including. In the elevator pitch, you need to have a hook. They call it a hook. It's a statement or a question that makes them want to hear more. It should be interesting. Think about it. There's always something interesting in your work, so think about this. Energy and passion, that's another thing. When a venture capitalist sees energy and passion, they feel like giving you the money because they believe with that passion, with that energy, you'll make it. Yes? The same with a scientist. A scientist who is excited about what she is doing immediately projects success. Dedication, passion, energy. Being in the audience, that's another thing that is relevant to this topic. You are devoting your time to the speaker. You are sacrificing an hour of your time. So you can also benefit from the presentation. Of course, you learn something that you didn't know. To come to all kinds of seminars, in your PhD program, you have to come to a few lectures, I think. I forgot what it's called. The quali specialistična, I think. It's kind of forcing you, but don't treat it as obligation. Pick those lectures, things that you would like to hear. If you learn one thing, one useful thing in each of them, it is well spent time. So do come there. You can help the speaker by listening, looking at the speaker. It will help the speaker to know that there is somebody in the audience who is interested. Try to follow, ask questions. That's what you can do. So if you are in the audience, especially if your colleague is presenting, be nice to the colleague. Here is another thing that I noticed, especially in Poland, the difference between Poland and US. In US, I noticed people are very, very gentle, very nice. They will rarely ask you embarrassing questions. They will do it in a round, you know. They will not say it directly. There is a whole spectrum of polite expressions that you can ask. in the conferences in Poland, I've seen aggressive behavior, really aggressive behavior that I thought, wow, why do they do that? Once I was in a conference with my wife, future wife, she wasn't my wife yet, and she is a small, those of you who know her, she's a small person, she's that height. She is tiny, you know, she is very small. And she was presenting a paper that I thought was really good work. I really thought highly about that paper. She was the sole author, and normally the audience was kind of, you know, sleepy, very polite. And then when she presented, there was suddenly a storm of questions and criticism. Luckily for her, she realized, she knew that that was good work, because she submitted it to a journal, she got very good reviews from that journal, so she knew there was really nothing terribly wrong with that paper. But it was an empirical paper, an experiment, and it's so easy to criticize experiments. In any case, the, you know, the last dog in the audience was barking. Pies kulawą nogą zadawał pytania. Very aggressive questions, anyway. Luckily, she felt quite secure. I mean, if she were insecure, they could have probably made her cry there, you know, because of that criticism. It was as if the paper was completely bad, useless. I've seen that not only with her, but I've seen sometimes a scientist say, no, this is not true, that cannot be true, or this is bullshit, you know. I've seen people say things like that. I don't think it's a good idea. Even if you think it's completely wrong, the paper, if something is wrong, you can say, well, it seems to me that there's an alternative explanation of the results, or there is a rival hypothesis. You can use vocabulary like this. Different results that you don't believe in. You can say, could it be that the results are due to experimental mortality, for example? You could ask questions like this, which are neutral. Or you can say, well, your results are very different than that of Smith, who published, like, you know, a few years ago. Do you know why? Do you have any insight why? You can ask critical questions, but in a very polite way. So definitely I wanted to make you aware of that, that you stay polite with asking questions. Several reasons. You don't want to embarrass a person. Why would you want that? Even if the person is wrong, let them find it out themselves. You don't want to make enemies without any reason. Why would you want to do that? That doesn't make any sense, yes? You want to help that person, not to insult or tramp down or whatever. What do you do when somebody is really wrong and the paper is completely bad beyond repair? What do you do then? You don't ask any questions. Because nothing could help that paper. Now that says also that if you present, and there's not a single question from the audience, doesn't look very good for you. You were not very clear, you didn't present it clearly, or people thought it was completely irrelevant, useless, or whatever. So try to avoid that situation. That's why you should present in a way that people understand you. When people understand you, most of the people in the audience understand you, there will be questions. I'm pretty sure there will be questions then. When you are, very soon, you will be asked to introduce speakers. For example, there is this doctoral student conference coming up in June. Maybe not you, but your older colleagues may be chairing sessions. Maybe they will be introducing speakers. So you are asked to introduce a speaker. Or your colleague from Krakow comes to here, you invited your colleague to give a presentation, you organized a seminar, you are the natural candidate to introduce the speaker. So here you should say at least the name of the speaker, go briefly through the educational background, especially where he or she got the PhD from, or that she is a PhD student at Jagiellonian University, working on this and this. Be polite, thankful for the person who comes here to present. Say something nice. Don't overdo it. Sometimes I see in Poland, I feel very embarrassed when people say that about me, wybitny, boy, I mean, so embarrassing to hear that. I mean, I have a feeling that they are trying to kind of, you know, overdo it. I wouldn't do that. I would just say what the person has done, the accomplishments, maybe rewards, awards, full professor, whatever, you know, say something objective, don't overdo it. Because when you overdo it, it is a little, you know, people get suspicious. Isn't he overdoing it, right? Isn't he ironic? The best introduction I heard, it was very kind of creative, was a colleague, Clark Glimmer, introducing Herb Simon. There was a symposium dedicated to him, 80th birthday. He came to the lecture and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I've always dreamt, all my life I've dreamt of introducing a speaker who doesn't need an introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, Herb Simon." That was really funny. Everybody was laughing. Laughing, I mean, in a very positive way, very funny way of introducing. So you can be funny. You can do it creatively. Very soon you'll be a conference session chair, as I mentioned. You should announce the session, explain the rules, 20 minutes talk, 5 minutes questions. I will be showing the time remaining, etc. You can explain those rules, and you have keep the order. You should introduce the speakers, check them out in the sense of look at their Google profile, what they have published, what they are doing, what they are working on, so that you can reasonably speak without reading on a paper, just say it nicely. You can make yourself familiar with the papers. There's a very good reason for that. Notably, if there are no questions, you know, it's a very embarrassing moment when there are no questions. As a chair of the session, you should ask questions. Typically, you are sitting with the audience, probably somewhere in the front. When the person is finished, you get up and say, "Well, we have 5 minutes for questions," and you see no questions. That's bad. So you say, "Well, in that case, I have a question." And then you ask a question, a genuine question. So you need to be prepared. You need to listen to the talk, or if you have the time, look at the paper also. You will definitely identify a few questions. So that's a very nice thing to do as a chair. Avoid that silence if needed. You should also break all kind of quarrels. If there is a quarrel, discussion, you should at some point say, "Well, in the name of not being late for the other speakers, may I propose that you continue this discussion in the during the break?" You just break it. It's your task. And also show when the time left. That's also a good practice so that they are not surprised that they have to finish. And then, if needed, you go to the podium and then just push them off. Their time is up. If needed, of course, use the force that is justified. Good examples of talks. First, I was a master's student, and my professor, my advisor, it was in the Netherlands, took a few of his students to go to a conference in Pisa in Italy. And there was an invited talk by David Patterson. Computer scientists probably know him. Author of several great ideas in computer architecture, the RISC idea, etc. Many people were using technology. They were printing using LaTeX, printing on the plastic slides, the text. David Patterson used pens. He made his slides on the plane, just writing with a pen. I mean, colored pen. His talk was absolutely the best in the conference, maybe because of the flexibility. Some things were not possible. These are possible now with PowerPoint, but they were not possible at the time. And he could just draw an arc from here to there, and, you know, it was so, so nice. I love that talk a lot. Justin Lindsay used Macintosh. There's a program that allows you to move through a graph, expands. That was quite innovative thing. I liked it. Similar thing was a colleague at University of Pittsburgh using mind map in Windows. Lawrence Lessig, if we have the time, we may have a couple of minutes, I'll play that fragment of the talk. Great. If you haven't watched Hans Rosling on TED, absolutely watch that talk, because he's giving an exemplary talk that is technology-oriented, technical data analysis. Amazing talk. Passive voice, I talked about this. I think you've seen this slide already. Avoid passive voice. There was another slide. Just the last slide, I'll tell you a joke, and maybe we can watch a couple of minutes of Lawrence Lessig, which is really very, very different way of talking. Keep your presentation simple, as simple as possible. Remember that the best spontaneity is a well-prepared spontaneity. That's something that my advisor in Warsaw, when I was still a kid, told me. The idea is that sometimes you see people who are so relaxed, you know, they put their hands in their pocket and they are just throwing out of their sleeves ideas and things. It seems like they are just so creative, so smart. The best spontaneous, the best spontaneity is well prepared. So practice, practice, and practice. You can achieve that. It all starts inside. So if you want to have a good attitude towards the audience, show them that you like them, that you love them, that you are thankful for them to come. Make sure that you think that way. So you cannot be a person who dislikes people. Generally, you know, just I don't like people, and you come to a lecture and then try to smile. That will look very funny. So just inside, make sure that you like people. It's a good idea to like people. Makes it easier to network, to get to know people, to be in the audience, to present. It's all inside you. Sometimes it is a good idea to be different and conventional. Some things are, of course, risky. I remember an anecdote. There was a conference where they were selling refrigerators. Whole day presentations from different companies, Zanussi, Bosch, etc. All parameters, graphs, prices, etc. 4 o'clock, last presentation from whatever company it was. The guy came up to the lecture and said, "You've seen 10 presentations today of excellent refrigerators with amazingly good parameters. Let me tell you, our refrigerators are in no way worse than they were. They are just as good, maybe better. And because it's the last presentation and you are probably very hungry, let's just finish here and go and have coffee or something." Very risky, of course, behavior, but according to that guy who was telling that anecdote, he got the most contracts, that last guy, just being funny. PowerPoint is a good tool, but it has also limitations. Fewer and fewer limitations than there used to be, but there are still limitations. So you could explore maybe different ways of presenting, of giving presentations. Connect with the audience and don't be boring, especially when people are waiting for lunch. Let me go back to that joke with Dr. Dropkin, the Jewish joke. How much time I have? Well, 5 minutes, so maybe we have still 2 minutes for the presentation. So, Dropkin, Slavic name, of course, a Jew from Eastern Europe, grew up in a small town, much smaller than Białystok. He went to elementary school, it's a long joke, but be patient, to high school. Then he went to study in a bigger town. He went to Boston. In Boston, he finished his undergraduate studies, then he got his master's degree, PhD, and then he became very, very well known in a very narrow field, got very well published, very famous. There was talking about him getting Nobel Prize. So one day, the government of that small town where he was born and where he grew up decided to invite him to visit the town. They wanted to kind of show off, you know, this famous person coming from the town. So the biggest hall in the town, all the radio stations, all the TV stations, red carpets, you know, they were painting the grass green, you know, big event for the town. Dr. Dropkin came there, of course, and it was the biggest room in the town, biggest hall. speakers, microphones, lecture. It was many, many years ago, so there were no PowerPoints, no computers, no presentation, no things. He came to the lecture and with his papers that he was going to read in his invited lecture, and the papers fell on the ground. So he went down to pick the papers, and because of the strain of the muscles and maybe the excitement of seeing some of the his colleagues from elementary school and in the audience, etc., his anal muscles got a little bit looser, and he passed gas straight to the microphone, which was amplified through the whole town. All the radio stations, all the TV stations amplified that. People in the street heard it. But of course, they were very polite, you know, small town. They didn't want to embarrass Dr. Dropkin. And he was also a worldly man. So he picked up the papers, and as if nothing happened, he read his lecture. Of course, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of clapping, a few questions. When the last clappings after the last questions subsided, he thanked to the audience, went through the back door, running to the hotel to pick up his luggage, taxi to the airport, and on the way he said to himself, never again, after such an embarrassing thing, will I appear in this town. I will never come back here. Never. But many years later, 25, 30 years later, some family matter brought him back to the town. He reserved a hotel under a different name, Goldberg. He came with a very late flight. He took a taxi. You know, it was already dark. It was almost midnight. He came to the hotel. There was a young man working in the hotel. He was maybe 20 or something. Well, who works at night, of course, young people. And he wanted to be very polite. So as he was typing his name into the computer, he asked, Mr. Goldberg, have you ever been in our town before, or is it your first visit? And Goldberg, Dropkin thought, well, you know, this is so late at night, just one person, and we have the tendency as humans to be very frank and honest in such situations. So he said, well, as a matter of fact, young man, I was born in this town, I went to school here, but many years ago, something so embarrassing happened that I decided never to come back again, but I had to come because of some family matters. And the young man wanted to be polite. He said, well, Mr. Goldberg, very often, I'm a very young guy, but very often we think that people are watching us, that they are noticing, but people don't pay attention, so I don't think you should really worry about it. And Dropkin says, I doubt anybody has ever forgotten what happened. So the young man says, you said it was many, many years ago. Yes, yes, many years ago. Was it before or after Dropkin fart? I think the original, the guy telling that is probably, you can find it there. The link is probably still active. Anyway, what I wanted to say with this joke is that certain things our reputation is very difficult to gain, very easy to lose, like in the Dropkin fart, right? You know, people are measuring time by that in that small town. We don't have the time to watch pieces of the other presentations, but try to watch them. It's very inspiring. I have spent a couple of decades picking those things for you, so I definitely recommend them. If you have a few minutes, maybe an hour, just watch some of them. Thank you very much. I think it's over, and we will talk about running a lab next week.